Gentlemen, good morning to you. You may approach.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and fellow justices. I'm Gene Hillman. I represent the appellant, Jeffrey Maddox, in this case. And at the outset, I want to concede that if the court is of a mind to apply what I'm going to call the modern-day law of descent and distribution and the decisions, analyzing those modern-day decisions, then the appellant probably is going to lose, because that's what the district court did here. And I think that is an error in a quiet title action, because this case is a quiet title action. It's not a case involving definition of a class of heirs involving adopted individuals. It's not a case deciding what an issue is under the current laws of adoption. It's a case to quiet title in the person that Charles Maddox intended to have eventual title. And I also want to withdraw a concession I made in the appellant's brief, and that concession was that Merrill Maddox could have adopted a child, adult or minor or otherwise, and made that child his eldest son for purposes of Charles Maddox's will. And the reason I say that is because the governing law at the time, and we have to remember that Charles Maddox's will was written in 1937. The governing law at the time was the case of In re Clark, cited in our brief. The will was written by lawyers in Pawnee City, longtime lawyers in Pawnee City. And that will uses the phrase, quote, eldest son, quote, eldest grandson in the male line, and also in the male line of descent, over 15 times. So it's fairly obvious that that will was referring to what was the common law of England, primogeniture, I think it was called, which favored the eldest male in the natural family line. And we also need to remember that at common law, adoption did not exist. Bloodline.
So are you arguing that even if this individual had been adopted as a child, they would not be eligible to inherit?
That's what In re Clark said. The 1933 decision of In re Clark, which was the law of the land at the time that Charles Maddox's will was drafted in 1937 by lawyers who were presumed to know the law. And if you take the language of the will.
But don't we have to focus on the adoption statutes in California and then give those statutes full faith and credit, whatever the effect?
That's exactly what In re Clark did.
Well, there are a number of adult adoption statutes in California, and was your client or was he adopted under the Chapter 14 of the California Adoption Code?
The appellee in this case?
Yeah.
He was adopted in Colorado at the age of 58.
At 58, but under what statute? Because there's different statutes that imply different rights and obligations.
I'm not arguing full faith and credit. I concede that.
Well, but the case I understand you concede it, and we have to give full faith and credit, but we have to give what effect are those statutes? What is the law there? And there's two different statutes in Colorado, and I'm just wondering, do you know which one he was adopted under?
I can't tell you right off the top of my head, but we're not contesting the fact that he was adopted in Colorado, and we're accepting the fact that a Nebraska court should give full faith and credit to that. That was the same situation in Ray Clark. When this will was written, that was the law of Nebraska was that this child that had been adopted in California in that case was entitled to have that adoption recognized and given full faith and credit. However, the court decided that didn't make that child an heir of a distant antecedent.
What would your argument be if the Colorado law was that when an adoption under a certain statute, that they don't take on the relationship of father, son, or anything like that.
Well, then I think the outcome here would be totally different, but my point is that it's the intent of the testator in a quiet title action who should inherit this particular property. That intent doesn't make any difference. All I'm saying is the In re Clark was the law. In re Clark gave full faith and credit to the California adoption, but found that that didn't make that adopted child an heir of the decedent.
But not all children, I'll just use a general term, come into the family in the same way, correct? They may be biologic kids, they could be step kids, they could be adopted kids, and so forth. Are there laws that are part of their baggage, notwithstanding their family members?
I don't understand the question here. All I'm trying to say is this is a quiet title action, and you have to look at what was the intent of the testator at the time the will was drafted, by whom it was drafted, the surrounding circumstances, and in this particular case, the fact that the...
As of the date of the will, then this person could not have been a son or heir of the testator.
That's what I'm saying.
Therefore, the testator could not have had that intent to include this adopted son.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And that in the quiet title action is the important issue. Who did the testator intend to have title to this real estate? And if you read the entirety of the will...
And it wouldn't have anything to do with full faith and credit.
No.
Because your primary issue is intent of the testator.
Correct. In a quiet title action, what created the title to this real estate? Well, it was this man's will. And what was his intent in drafting that will?
So we're to figure out what the intent was in 1937 just by the face of the will.
Well, but it's not hard to do. If you read the entire will, it uses eldest grandson in the male line, in the male line of descent, eldest son. Well,
your reading of that is by a biologic basis.
Yes, because of the decision of In re Clark, which was the law at the time, which says the intention of the testator, what was in his mind, the language used, his relationship to the objects of his bounty, the consideration of the entire will, the natural tendency to keep in the channel of descent by blood, the surrounding circumstances, and all are familiar aids in the interpretation when applied to a particular case.
But
to ascertain
this, Mr. Hillman, if the Colorado statute in which the adult was adopted did not create a father-son relationship, where are you?
I don't know that it makes any difference.
Well, then you wouldn't. My
argument
is inherit. That's the answer to that question.
Well, yeah, but I don't think it addresses what I'm my main point here. And
well, it might coincide with the outcome you seek.
That could be, yes, it would. But I don't know that you need to get that far in terms of deciding this quiet title action. You've got to decide what the intent of the testator was, and it certainly wasn't to have this property passed to an individual who was adopted some 70 years later at the age of 58 by somebody who was 80. Charles Maddox couldn't have intended that. And if you read his will and apply the existing law at the time, drafted by lawyers, it's obvious they were hung up on what was the common law, which you may or may not like, but
and
that's what it was.
That because that was the law at the time the will was created, it was not necessary for the testator to anticipate any other provisions regarding adoption or anything else because he couldn't be included under the existing law.
Correct.
He could not have imagined this.
That occurring. And he didn't intend that to occur. That's my point.
In this case, it probably doesn't make any difference, but just to be clear, isn't the testator's intent as of the date of death as opposed to the date of drafting?
Yes. And that was 1938, right, as stipulated to, and it was the same law when the deed creating the interest in this estate was filed in 1941. Only in the later 40s and the early 80s did the law of adoption and descent and distribution start to change. And that can't change the intent of a testator in 1937 or 38. But I would agree, Justice Castle, that it's the intent of the testator at the time of death. But his will wasn't changed between his writing the will and his death. So, and it's a quiet title action. It's not a will construction action.
Because the will directly addresses the situation. It says the eldest son in fee simple. The other language upon which you rely has to do with the in the event there was no eldest son. What difference does that make?
Well, I agree with that observation, but I think the rest of the will, and like, again, you have to look at the entire will, uses old common law language from primogeniture principles that we want to, this is eldest son, eldest grandson, eldest in the male line of descent. It's all talking about common law principles of blood inheritance.
So even though it doesn't directly apply, it speaks to intent.
Yes. Yes. And also the case law at the time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bowman Anderson. Good morning to you. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Good morning. Very close. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Heather Vogley Anderson, and along with my co-counsel, Brenda Smith, we represent the interests of the appellee, Roger Burnett. To comment on a couple of the issues that counsel raised in his argument regarding if we follow the law of today in regard to how the outcome of this case would resolve, it is clear that the trial court was correct in determining that Mr. Burnett is entitled to quiet title in the real estate that's at issue in Pawnee County, Nebraska. The case repeatedly cited by counsel in his argument was In Re Estate of Clark. Clark was abrogated by In Re Estate of Darling by this court, wherein it indicated that the statutory changes that had occurred in Nebraska caused the adoption of an adult to create a parent-child relationship, and as a result, they are entitled to inherit just as if they were a natural-born child.
Well, doesn't that conflict with what may have been the intent of the testator in creating the will in 1938?
Well, we only look outside the actual language of the will if there's an ambiguous state in the will. And also the will says in regard
okay,
to...
Okay, and how did he obtain this father-son relationship based on the adoption in Colorado?
The decree for adult adoption, which is Exhibit C to Exhibit 1 in the Bill of Exception, provides, it is therefore ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the petition for adult adoption is hereby granted and that the name of the adult is retained and that said adult now becomes the heir at law of the petitioner and said adult is entitled to inherit from petitioner any property in all respects as if such adopted person had been the petitioner's child born in lawful wedlock. So the decree in Colorado specifically provides for the father-son relationship.
The statutory change to which you refer occurred many years after 1938, right?
Agreed, Your Honor.
And so basically the heart of this issue is, do we have to look at the state of the law as it existed in 1938 at the death of the testator that created this scheme of descent, or may we consider the evolution of the law thereafter?
You may consider the evolution of the law pursuant to this court's decisions.
Isn't that, you're advocating for the latter, I understand, but that's the key question that we have.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't believe I'm just advocating for it. I believe it's what's been decided by this court in a number of opinions, In Re Darling, most recently the Nixon case, Statterfield. These issues in all of those cases, the statutory change allowing for this type of adult or allowing and changing the adoption status in Nebraska came after all of those wills were drafted. The statutory change came after all of those. And in Re Darling, the court stated, it is true, as certain of the natural children argued, that the textress could not have known of the adoptions, for she had both executed her will and died before they took place. Her lack of knowledge, however, is not significant. She would have been equally ignorant of any natural children sired by Darlene after her death. The important point is she had no control over who became Darlene's children or by what means. So the court determined there that in terms of who would become later born children, which is later born or later children for purposes of inheritance, the court determined that it didn't matter what they knew or didn't know, could or couldn't happen at that point. What the court found here was that they provided for the children, or in this case, the eldest son of Merrill Maddox to receive.
What about the language in the will that talks about blood descendants?
I think Justice Castle commented on that exactly to the point that I would make, which is I don't agree that there are other references in the will to the male line of descendant. Interestingly, the provision we're dealing with in this case related to quiet title does not include that language. It simply says it goes to Merrill Maddox and to said farm with the remainder over at his death to his eldest son in fee simple.
We construe the will, you know, as a whole. We don't just look at the snippet that we like. We have to take the entire will, the four corners of the will, correct?
We do, but what the case law has said is that if we look at the four corners of the will and there's not a contrary intention to exclude adopted children, a specific contrary intention to exclude them, then we determine that they're included for purposes of the will.
What does blood descendant mean?
I think we would obviously concede that blood descendant means a natural born child.
In 1938, when the decedent died, Merrill Maddox, the second life tenant, had no children at that point, correct?
That is correct.
He was a life then in existence, but had no children at all.
Correct. The adoption occurred in 2000, of Mr. Burnett occurred in 2006. We find that this case is very similar to many of the issues raised in In Re Darlene in the Nixon case, all of which this court determined that the adopted adult was entitled to inherit under the terms.
Does it matter that those were a different form of action?
We would
not quiet title.
We would assert absolutely not. First and foremost, the In Re Clark case, just to be clear, that counsel relies on, is not a quiet title action either. It's an action to interpret. It's an equity action to interpret certain provisions, but it is not a quiet title action. It involves shares of capital stock. So to draw the distinction of a quiet title action, but then to rely on In Re Clark, shows that it is clear that the will interpretation statutes and the estate document interpretation statutes are the same, whether or not it's a quiet title action or whether or not it's a will interpretation or some kind of other declaratory action to make that decision. If it were not that case, we would have a situation where people would be running to the courthouse to determine, well, maybe if I file under quiet title, I win under this scenario, but if I file in a probate
proceeding. Well, they're all based upon the construction of the will.
Agreed, Your Honor.
That's the genesis of the title.
Agreed, Your Honor.
So this is the play within the play.
It is. Based on the clear statutory requirements of Nebraska Revised Statute 43-110 and the current governing law of the state of Nebraska under the various cases we've cited throughout the brief, we think it is clear that the trial court correctly found that Roger Burnett was entitled to have the title to the land quieted his name, and for those reasons, we would ask that this court affirm the decision of the trial court and find that Mr. Burnett is entitled to the land.
Before you sit down, the trouble I have with that last statement is, I think, don't we look at the law, we look at what this will meant in 1938, we don't incorporate into it subsequent changes in the law. The will spoke as of the testator's death, and whatever it said then is what controls today. Isn't that the law?
Well, what the will says is that it goes to the eldest son, and you determine who the eldest son is at the date of Merrill Maddox. You don't determine it at the date of the date Charles Maddox died. You make that determination at the date that Merrill Maddox died, and at the date Merrill Maddox died, his son, Roger Burnett, was his son.
In other words, it was a contingent remainder, not a vested remainder, is the heart of your argument.
Exactly, exactly, Your Honor. And it was the exact decision that the trial court reached in finding that, yes, there are a number of principles in regard to vesting as early as possible, unless there is something contrary in the will. And by providing that it was his eldest son, the eldest son of Merrill Maddox, and it related to deaths of different people, it could not have become a vested interest at the time of the testator's death.
Because of the facts.
Correct.
And then you proceed through the contingency.
Correct, Your Honor.
If Merrill Maddox had had a son in 1938, would this will language have vested that remainder interest in that person at that time? And if so, what's your explanation? Why not? It seems to me that it would have.
Well, I think the distinction is that this particular piece of land related to Merrill Maddox himself. Each of the five nephew's sons got a piece of land. And so if Merrill Maddox had an actual son during that time period, then the contingency related to if Merrill Maddox didn't have a son and then the eldest grandson, I think, goes away. So there's an argument potentially that there would have been a vesting there, but I still think there's contingency requirements of who was alive at the time of Merrill Maddox's death. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is Cisneros versus Graham.